Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Vaca with co-host, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson, and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webnode.com. Today, we will be doing part two of our discussion with scientist Eric Lerner. Eric Lerner is president and chief scientist at LPP Fusion, a small clean energy R&D company. He is the author of The Big Bang Never Happened, and for 30 years has been one of the leading cosmology researchers who are critical of the Big Bang hypothesis. His papers have been published in major peer-reviewed journals such as Astrophysical Journal and the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. He is also an active researcher in the effort to develop fusion energy, the power of the sun and stars, for use here on Earth. He has been a socialist activist for decades and is currently a member of the Jobs and Equal Rights for All campaign and international Luxembourgist network. Eric, thank you for joining us today.
Okay, well, thanks for having me back.
So, Eric, last week you shared with us your background, your research, your challenge to the mainstream hypothesis of the Big Bang, and as I said earlier in our intro, the sociological aspect as to why that theory is very much upheld. We're hoping you could share with us now, for this part two of this series, the alternative model that you're proposing to the Big Bang and how this relates to fusion technology here on Earth.
Right. Well, what I'm proposing is not a big alternative model, a theory of everything, according to Eric Lerner. What I'm pointing out and what my colleagues are pointing out is that if you get rid of the grand narrative, the grand myth of a Big Bang, the dark energy, the dark matter, this whole fairy tale, and simply use the science that we have established and verified here on Earth, then you can develop a understanding of the evolution of the universe that coheres with what we observe. Simply getting rid of these unnecessary and false hypotheses is the real alternative. Well, let me describe a little bit about how that works. In the last section, I pointed out that one of the key evidences against the Big Bang is that the Big Bang hypothesizes that before there were galaxies, before there were stars, before there was anything, the Big Bang would have to have produced by thermonuclear reactions a certain amount of helium, a certain amount of lithium, a certain amount of deuterium. And for helium and lithium, two out of those three, the predictions are way off. Well, we know from our experiments on Earth and from our observations of stars like the sun that there's another way of producing these elements which doesn't require a Big Bang. First of all, helium is the main product produced by fusion reactions in the sun and in all the stars that exist like the sun. So the main source of energy in the entire universe is the reaction that, and sometimes, and it has a lot of intermediate steps, but the net result of the reaction is to convert hydrogen into helium with the release of an enormous amount of energy. So what I did starting up papers published in the 1980s, and I wasn't the only one working on this, I created mathematical models of how a galaxy would form. And in a second I'll get to some of how these models were created. And these models predicted that as a galaxy formed, The first stars formed would be large stars, more massive than the Sun, starting with about 12 times the mass of the Sun. The way stars function is that the larger the star is, the more it pushes itself together through its own gravitation, and the faster the nuclear reactions go. So a star that is 12 times as big as the Sun, as massive as the Sun, that star is going to be thousands of times brighter, tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands times brighter. So even though it has more hydrogen, it's going to be burning through that hydrogen in tens of millions of years, not like the Sun, tens of billions of years. So as a galaxy forms, you have this birth cry, as it were, in which very rapidly many large stars form, and they produce large amounts of helium very rapidly. So back in the 1980s, I did those calculations and showed how much helium would be produced. Now, it turns out the helium that would be produced in those stars in a galaxy that's forming would be exactly what we observed, approximately 25%. There would be a bit of a range because each galaxy would have a slightly different history. And that made predictions that could later be tested, because that predicted that as we look out into space and we see galaxies forming a long time ago, because when we're looking out into space, we're looking back into time, they would be much brighter than our galaxy today. And that's what, in the decades subsequent to these predictions, that's exactly what people saw. They saw these extremely bright galaxies relative to their mass that were producing vast amounts of helium. So that's where the helium came from. Now, deuterium and lithium, we know, can be formed in the galaxy by another process, which is cosmic ray collisions. So all stars, including our Sun, produce cosmic rays. These are particles, hydrogen nuclei, which are protons mostly, and helium nuclei, which are accelerated by the magnetic field in the stars to very high velocities and very high energies. Most of these are trapped by the star's own magnetic field and slam back into the stars. And some of them escape, and then they collide with matter throughout the galaxy. Now, in some of these collisions, a proton and a proton will collide. So a proton accelerated at a cosmic ray will collide with hydrogen nuclei that's just sitting there, and that collision will produce deuterium. Other collisions, when the hydrogen collides, for example, with a carbon nucleus, and carbon can be produced by stars fusing together helium, so that's in a later stage of their evolution, this can produce lithium. Lithium is produced, it's like a fragment of these collisions. So these processes have all been studied in the laboratory where we can accelerate these particles and by our space probes moving through the solar system. And we can observe these processes as the Sun expels these cosmic rays. So again, back in the 80s, I did these calculations, and then I redid them with more data this year. If you look at the chart shows the comparisons of the predictions made by this galactic origin of light elements theory, what I call GOEL. In astronomy, people love cutesy abbreviations. I've deliberately misspelled goal here to make a standard astronomical abbreviation. So the goal theory 1989, the goal theory 2020, where I updated it, and observations all come out very close for deuterium, helium, lithium, and even other elements that are produced by cosmic rays, beryllium and boron. So without a Big Bang, just with the known processes that are occurring in our galaxy and in other galaxies, nuclear fusion in stars and cosmic rays, you have the production of the correct amount of light elements. So that is the alternative to the Big Bang creation of light elements. So let me stop here for a second, and if you want to ask a question.
I'm curious as to the reception of that your proposition, and, you know, back then and now.
The reception has changed. In other words, if you look back even as recently as, let's say, 20 years, the beginning of this century, people were really very hostile to any criticisms of the Big Bang theory. And it was very difficult to get published in major journals. So I and the few dozen colleagues who we met together as critics of the Big Bang, we would still get published, but in much smaller journals that were sort of off to the side. Well, things have changed over the past decade. There is a bit more openness. So things are being published in major journals. Now, I haven't published this more recent work. It's still in progress. I expect to publish it this year. But I presented this in January, right before the coronavirus shut down international conferences, at an Astronomical Society meeting in Honolulu. So basically, I would say the main reaction was a very few people would say, "You're spot on. I've been arguing for years that something's going on in this other part of the theory," or whatever. Mostly, I would say it's head scratching. People would listen politely. They wouldn't know what to do with it because all their colleagues, you know, think the Big Bang is right. And they would sort of move on to the next presentation. So at the moment, I would say the critics are still trying to get the attention focused on the critical debate: is the Big Bang a valid theory? That hasn't happened yet. So I'll get more into some of how these other arguments are received.
And first off, I guess I have two questions. First is, when I think about what I know about the Big Bang, it's not really entirely clear to me what the description of how galaxies formed out of the Big Bang. Like, what does that model propose how galaxies are formed, and how is it different from the goal model, the one that you're proposing, that explains the origins of the light elements?
Well, that's what I want to get into next, because as I said in the last episode, a second key problem with the Big Bang is that the large scale structures, which are not galaxies, the larger scale structures are clusters of clusters of clusters of galaxies, take too long to form in the period since the Big Bang. Again, if you simply throw out the Big Bang and you say, how could have these structures formed? You find that they could have formed using only three processes that are well known and well understood in the laboratory. And those processes are gravitational contraction and two processes that occur with electromagnetic fields, which is the filamentation instability and what's called the Faraday disk or homopolar disk effect. So let me explain that. First of all, let's take the filamentation instability, which is also called the pinch effect. So what happens is, in any place where you have currents of electricity, and in the universe as a whole, you have to have currents of electricity because you have currents wherever you have plasma, which is electrons free to move. And most of the universe consists of plasma. So when you have currents moving in the same direction, the magnetic fields that they create pull the currents towards each other. If they're moving in opposite directions, they're pushed away from each other. Now, this effect that was discovered by Ampere 200 years ago is one of the fundamental effects that is used in electric technology. Every motor in existence, including the fan in your computer, uses these interactions of currents in its basic function. So if you have currents moving through a plasma where the gas is free to move, this creates filaments. And we see these filaments at all scales. In the laboratory, we see them in our fusion device, which I'll be getting into again a little later. At the micron level, these filaments are formed, and they're hundreds of microns across. If we take our telescopes and we go out into the universe, and we see these same filaments at radiuses forming the clouds that form stars at radiuses of a hundredth or five hundredths of a light year. So that's millions of trillions of times bigger than the scale of our lab. If we go out even further, we see them half light year radius, and we go out even further, we see filaments of galaxies that are 5 million light years in radius. So it scales from tiny, from basically the diameter of human hair, up to scales that light takes millions or even billions of years to cross. We see this filamentation. So what you have in, we can look back, as I say, when we look out into space, we're looking back in time, and we can see that as the universe, which doesn't have an origin time, started to form through the pinch effect, these huge currents, when these currents got big enough, massive enough, then gravitation started to become significant at a very large scale. This is billions of light years, and started to gradually contract these massive plasma balls that would eventually become the galaxies. Well, one thing that scientists know is that if something is slowly spinning, and these filaments are slowly spinning, and it tries to contract, it will start spinning faster. If you remember your high school physics, angular momentum is conserved, if something contracts its spinning, it spins faster until it can actually fight the gravitational contraction. So this process wouldn't have gotten very far except for the third effect, which is called the Faraday disk effect, which was again discovered 200 years ago by Michael Faraday, which is if you have a conductor of electricity spinning in a magnetic field, electric currents are created that move towards the center and out along the axis. Now, what these currents do is that they transfer, you can think of it as like giant arms spinning around, and these arms are slowing down the rotation of the body. They're transferring angular momentum outwards, and that allows the body to contract further and further. As the body contracts and as these currents start flowing into the center, those currents are again subject to the filamentation instability. So you produce filaments at a smaller scale. So this process first, and this was extending over trillions of years of time, this process first produced blobs that would become superclusters of galaxies, then clusters of galaxies, finally galaxies, and then within the galaxies, compressing until you got stars. And when you got stars, something really different happened, because stars were so compressed and so hot that thermonuclear reactions started to create a new source of energy. So all this previous creation of structure was driven just by the energy of gravitational contraction, just like a ball rolling downhill. But when you get to stars, the stars, because of their high density, started to release fusion reactions, which were thousands and millions of times more energetic and the amount of energy available from gravity. And that suddenly basically turned on the energy sources. Galaxy by galaxy, you would have the bright universe that we see today come into existence. Now, this description of the origin of structure, I published this based on earlier work by Hannes Alfvén, who I mentioned last time won the Nobel Prize in physics in 1970. I developed it in a more quantitative manner in 1986, and I showed that quantitatively, just from the science we know here on Earth, the science of electromagnetism and plasma physics, we could actually predict the size and spacing of these clusters of galaxies and stars. So you had a quantitative description, which has really held up in the subsequent 35 years as we've discovered more and more about the structure in the universe. These predictions from back then have actually been verified. So again, in contrast to the Big Bang, which to form these structures, take my word for it, requires dark matter, this invisible, whatever, fairy dust matter. It requires all these special assumptions. If you get rid of the Big Bang, you can do the same enormous structuring of the universe just using the physics and the science we know here on Earth.
And I guess there's a lot of things that come to my mind. First, so stars are some of the last things, most recent things that have been made in the universe. Is that what you're saying? And is that what pretty much everyone agrees with?
Remember, this is a I should clarify that this is a process that's coming together throughout the universe, and obviously there's a certain variation to it. In parts of the observable universe, you have galaxies that have come together at earlier stages. So you can imagine that as these filaments contract, certain parts get to the critical densities that form galaxies. The galaxies get to the critical point that they're forming stars. This is happening, again, to use Alfayne's phrase, like a fireworks display. Mm-hmm. The fireworks don't all go off at once. Mm-hmm. They're going off. There was obviously, we can tell by our observations, that there was a period billions of years ago in which star formation was occurring actually much more rapidly than it was today. And the universe was much livelier place, maybe too lively for life to exist. And then it sort of started to calm down as the galaxy formation and the star formation process reached their conclusion. So think of it as, you know, fireworks or fireflies, bright stars bursting into existence. And in our own galaxy, stars are still coming into existence. We can see with the Hubble telescope, we can see what they call stellar nurseries, which are these big clouds of gas held together by magnetic fields and gravitation, which give rise to stars, and we can see with our telescope these stars forming. So this is a process that's ongoing right now. Mm-hmm.
Correct me if I'm wrong. So this means that the explanation of the origin of, you know, the universe remains unanswered.
What we're talking about is getting rid of the idea of an origin of the universe. I mean, this goes back before the development of the Big Bang theory. In the 19th century, it was simply assumed that the basic concept of the basic hypothesis of all science is that you can explain natural phenomena by cause and effect. So all effects have causes. Nothing happens miraculously. Well, logically speaking, that means that there is no first cause. So it was assumed that even though any object within the universe, you or me, or this house I'm living in, or the Earth itself, had an origin in time, the universe did not have an origin in time, because that would assume a first cause, an effect that did not have a cause. So we're going back to that. If we throw out the Big Bang, we're saying the universe, which is everything, doesn't have an origin in time. Again, I'll quote Alfayne one more time. He said, to try and create a narrative, a grand cosmic narrative, leads to myth, a myth of the origins. To try and replace ignorance with knowledge in larger volumes of space and time is science. So science can look backwards further and further and further without ever reaching a wall. If you look at the narrative that I just described, basically you see a universe whose evolution is continuously speeding up. So, as I say, it's a universe that's running up, not running down. You can put it scientifically in terms of the energy flow density. How much energy is flowing through a given area in a given amount of time? And what we see is that energy flows have always increased. That's sort of the theme song of the evolution of the universe, is increasing energy flows, and that the rate of evolution of these energy flows has also increased. So like this time scale of the origin of these primordial vortices was trillions of years. We know that from their size and their velocities. The formation of superclusters of galaxies took tens of billions of years. Of clusters of galaxies, billions of years. Our galaxy took only a few hundred million years to form, to actually start going. A star only takes a few million years to form, and the final stages of contraction of a star like our sun only take thousands of years. We can see the acceleration of evolution continuing with biological evolution, in which biological evolution time scale has shortened from billions of years to hundreds of millions to tens of millions, and in the evolution of humanity to even hundreds of thousands of years. So basically, if you go forward in time, you see an acceleration of evolution. And if you go backwards in time, you see everything slowing down. So you can go backwards in time indefinitely without ever either reaching a wall where it says, oh yeah, this is the beginning of the story, or having a static universe. The universe isn't static. It's always been evolving. But as you go back further in time, as you look back further in time, it evolves more slowly. As you move the story in the direction that the universe actually evolved, you get a story that becomes quicker and quicker, an evolution that becomes more and more rapid. Is that sort of clear?
Yeah. I mean, I think that is a notion of that the evolution of things is accelerating in time as it moves forward. And
right.
It's just been picking up speed as time goes on within the universe. And the other thing I hear behind this kind of model is an insistence that there needs to be a connection between what we say about how the universe is formed to actual physical experiments that we can do here. There needs to be a connection between those things. And if they aren't connected, then we're doing something wrong. We're going in a wrong direction if that connection is broken.
That's right. So let me just give you two more points of how we can or cannot explain the phenomena that the Big Bang tries to explain in a different way without the Big Bang. The third case is a cosmic microwave background. Cosmic microwave background is said to be the echo of the Big Bang, but of this tremendously hot event. But the temperature of this microwave background is very cold. It's a little less than 3 degrees Absolute. It's very, very cold. Now, if we want to say what is the origin of the energy, if it wasn't the Big Bang, what supplied the energy? And there is quite a bit of energy in this microwave background. Even though it's very cold, it pervades the entire space that we can observe. And again, decades ago, other people pointed out that if you take the energy that must have been released when 25% of the hydrogen in the universe was converted in the stars to helium, my goodness, it turns out to be exactly the same amount of energy as in the microwave background. So that's where the energy came from. And the question is, how did it get into this uniform band? Well, the first stage is very obvious. We can models that I and others created back in the 80s showed that in the early stage of a galaxy formation, you would have a lot of dust, because after the after the larger stars burned hydrogen to helium through the fusion process, they would burn the helium to carbon. And that carbon would form, of course, dust. And that would make the light, that would absorb the light and re-emit it as infrared radiation, much cooler radiation. In addition, I and others have shown that very dense magnetic filaments or even spinning dust can scatter that radiation into a microwave bath. So you basically are looking at a fog that is created by the smoothing of this radiation, initially created by stars, into this even bath. Well, if that's true, then you can test that observation. If you are standing in the middle of a fog and you take and a friend takes a flashlight and moves away from you, that flashlight light is going to dim much faster because you're in the fog than if you were standing on a clear night. Well, observations have shown that as we look out into space, the amount of radio radiation we get from galaxies goes down much more rapidly than the amount of infrared and optical radiation, because the universe is almost transparent at optical wavelengths, but it has this radio fog at radio wavelengths. So this was demonstrated again back in the 90s. I published this in major journals, and then in the more recent period, people have done observations that show this goes out to very high distances, very high redshifts. And you see a 100-fold fall off in the radio radiation relative to the IR radiation as you go out into space. So the universe is not transparent to these microwaves, to a form of radio waves. And that, again, means that we have a way of making the microwave background without a big bang. In the interest of time, let me just go on to the final example, which is the one case where we can't exactly explain it, which is the Hubble relationship itself. If the Big Bang, the expansion of the universe, is not causing the redshift, what is? Well, what I and my colleagues demonstrated is that you can fit the supernova data, the data that relates the brightness of a supernova to its distance, to its redshift, by simply assuming a very simple formula that the redshift is directly proportional to distance. Using that simple formula, you can get as good a fit to the data as the Big Bang does using dark energy and dark matter and inflation and the expansion of the universe. So by Occam's razor, you can get a much better fit with just, you know, one free parameter, which is the Hubble parameter. Now, if you ask, well, what causes light to lose energy? Then we have to answer, yeah, we don't know. This would have to be a modification to the laws of electromagnetism. But we can test that experimentally, because we have sufficiently sensitive instruments to measure small differences in wavelength or in frequency. If we send these out into space onto satellites that are millions of kilometers separated, we could, in theory, measure such a modification of electromagnetism here in the solar system. So in that one case, we would need a new law of physics, but it's something that could be tested with observations here in the solar system. So I'll stop there because I do want to get on to the connection with fusion.
Yeah, and just to say that my understanding of the way the Big Bang talks about the redshift is that the reason that the light energy coming from these stars is losing its energy is not about a function of its distance, although it's a function of its speed moving away. And this dark energy that's pushing things more away from us. So that's that explanation. And this one says, no, there is no dark energy. There's no expansion. That the distance itself is creating the difference in the energy of the light. And that's why you're saying, well, we don't know if we've seen that before, so there's going to have to be experiments that show that that effect could happen. That model would have to be tested because in many ways, maybe the only thing the only thing I hear that they have that is experimental evidence is the redshift itself. Seems to be the only experimental evidence that can be used to give some claim that there's an expanding universe.
Ultimately, the expanding universe is a hypothesis to explain the observed redshift data.
Right.
What we're saying is there are other hypotheses, and these hypotheses can be tested experimentally. Right. Not exactly on Earth, but with spacecraft that can be launched from Earth. Let me just briefly go on into, you know, what the technology... I discussed a little last time what sort of the ideological connection was in the cosmology. Let me just discuss a bit the technological. Because the same plasma theory that I and Dr. Alfain and others have used to explain processes in the universe, we can use that understanding of those processes to produce fusion energy on Earth. So let me just briefly give it as an example, the device that we're using in our laboratory in Middlesex, New Jersey. And we have on our website a little video that illustrates how this works. So this device called the dense plasma focus, because it focuses energy, uses the pinch instability or the pinch effect to enormously compress and heat plasma until we get in our laboratory routinely temperatures that are hundreds of times hotter than the center of the sun. So what happens is we have a device that has energy storage devices called capacitors, which are about this big. And this dumps energy into our experimental device in a very sudden pulse, just a few millionths of a second more. So from a small amount of energy, we get very high currents, millions of amperes of current, for a very short amount of time. So this current starts to flow from an outer electrode, which is only about this big, to an inner electrode, from the cathode to the anode, through a vacuum chamber, which is filled with a fusion fuel. Because of the pinch effect, the current pinches into filaments and fountains into a focus area where the filaments twist together into a tiny little ball of plasma we call a plasmal. This little ball of plasma, in our experiments, is only a fraction of a millimeter across, and we're trying to compress it even more. Because so much energy is compressed into so little space, in a few billionths of a second, this little plasmoid heats up through a form of basically viscous or frictional heating to billions of degrees temperature. And fusion reactions start to occur, just like in the center of the sun, but enormously faster, so that we get measurable amounts of fusion from this tiny plasmoid lasting only 10 billionths of a second. The energy comes out mostly in the form of a charged particle beam of ions, which is produced by this plasma. So the beauty of this approach is we can, because it produces such a high temperature, billions of degrees, we can use a fusion fuel that produces absolutely no radioactive waste. And this fusion fuel is made of hydrogen, which we can get from water, and boron, which is a very common element. Hydrogen plus boron together react to produce 3 helium nuclei. No neutrons are produced. Neutrons is what produces radioactive waste. So what we get is a process that is completely clean. No chemical waste, obviously nothing like CO2, no radioactive waste. And the energy comes out in terms of a beam that could be directly converted into electricity in a circuit without going through an expensive steam cycle where you produce heat to produce steam to run a generator and a turbine. So the whole thing can potentially be 10 times cheaper than any energy source. Now, the device itself only cost us about $500,000 to build, and it can fit into a very small room. It's literally a lab in a garage, as it were, although ours is in a storage center. We have not gotten yet to the point where this device produces more fusion energy out than then is put into the device. That's what we're working on right now. But we do produce fusion with almost every shot. And if we can perfect this device, this could completely replace fossil fuels. So we could have trillions of dollars literally saved every year from not going to the oil and gas company. And the physics behind, the concepts behind this, basically come from the study of plasmas at all scales. We know the physics is right because it works from all scales, from the laboratory to the solar system out into space. So I'll stop again for questions.
Yes.
Yeah. What would it take for you to perfect it? I guess I'm wondering.
Okay. Well, what we're working on now, in order to get more net energy out of the device and goes into it, you need 3 ingredients. One is sufficient temperature, and we have that, even though it's billions of degrees for this tiny amount of time. You need enough time to confine the plasma. And even though that's billions of seconds, that is enough time. What we don't have is sufficient density. The density we would need is approximately the density, almost the density of the war. And we're much below that. We're about 1/100th the density of air. So we're down by a factor of thousands from the density we need to reach. And the basic reason why we're not there yet is because as the magnetic fields compress this plasma, they have to compress it very evenly. If one side is compressed a little ahead of the others, everything doesn't arrive at the same instant. So you don't get good enough compression, you don't get high enough density. Without going into the details, which we describe at great length on our website, that good compression is what we're trying to work on. And we think that we may get there in the next 12 months or so. Now, we've been held up, like everybody else, a little bit by the virus. But mainly right now, we're waiting for new equipment to arrive. And we hope to be starting experiments again in the fall or the winter. So the next stage, which we think will only cost us maybe another $1 or $2 million, is to prove in the laboratory that we can get more energy out than we get in. The next step is a lot more costly, which is engineering and development to convert a laboratory device, which we can fire once every 20 minutes, into a generator that fires 200 times a second, which roughly is as fast as your car fires its spark plugs. So engineering always is more expensive than research. This is something that would cost maybe $50 or $100 million, which we hope we would get from the government, to actually perfect an engineering, a prototype device, which could be manufactured in a factory. So that would take maybe another 3 or 4 more years once we got the funding.
One more thing about that. Where have you worked with other scientists globally, or have you are partnering with other scientists that are also using this device?
Right. This device was invented back in the 1960s, simultaneously in the United States and the Soviet Union. So there are now about 40 or 45 groups, small groups like ours, around the world, working on this device. And we get together, we've been getting together again until the coronavirus, about annually, to meet together. Now, the problem is that because the government fusion effort decided back 40 years ago, concentrate almost exclusively on tokamaks, the dense plasma focus has not been funded by governments for fusion. So my colleagues are generally studying it for other applications, not because they don't believe it could be used for fusion, but because they simply are government or university facilities that can't get funding to experiment with this for fusion. So since we have raised private money to allow us to go forward with fusion experiments, right now we're the only DPF group in the world that's working exclusively on fusion. But the fact that we have many colleagues, literally a couple of hundred colleagues that we can collaborate with, means that we can benefit from a free exchange of experimental evidence with other devices that are similar to ours. So that's a big help that really leverages our small group with less than half a dozen researchers and connects us to a much bigger group.
And last time you talked about the cosmology scientific community is kind of a priesthood holding back that area of research that was an alternative to the Big Bang theory. What are the political and social sources of friction towards getting more financing and getting the government to promote or look at these alternative energy methods.
Yeah, it's really tough because, as I mentioned last time, the sociology of cosmology has made change very difficult in two big ways. And in a way, fusion is almost easier. Cosmology, unlike fusion, is not linked in the conventional approach to technology. Traditional cosmologists, mainstream concordance cosmologists, as they call themselves, they don't pay attention to plasma phenomena. So they think that everything that goes on in the universe is only gravitation. And gravitation is important only on very large scales. So there's no real connection to technology. That means all of cosmology is funded by the government. There's almost no private cosmology. And that's funded by just two committees that are in each country very concentrated and very conservative. So that's a big problem. The good thing is that publication has been opened up. So we are publishing even in big journals like the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. I think that what's going to happen over the next year or so is that the admitted crisis in cosmology that comes from the failure of many predictions that come out of their theory of the cosmic microwave background is going to open up a discussion for alternatives. I also think that a key thing is to cut through the argument, oh yeah, there's this problem, there's that problem, but overall the theory is sound. We need to publish papers, and I'm working on one such paper, that basically says in a single paper, well, no, the Big Bang doesn't have any predictions that are sound. It's all hole and no cheese. So then we start the discussion about we've got to go in another direction because the Big Bang really has, the emperor really has no clothes. It's not just that the elbow is naked and the knee is naked. There really are no clothes on this emperor.
And one last thing, but there are private companies, there are giant private energy companies that could be looking into this or trying to see how this could be developed. They are also looking at this or not. What is their role in helping this technology be developed?
The energy companies that are tied up with fossil fuels, they are not going to want this technology to prosper at all. It's a threat to their entire solvency. If you have cheap fusion energy, the price of oil will go down to almost nothing. And not only these companies, but the banks that have lent them all these trillions of dollars are going to go bankrupt. I mean, we saw in the coronavirus that at a $20 a barrel price, everybody was in danger of going down the tubes. So they're obviously going to be hostile, and we expect them to use whatever influence they have with government to regulate us out of existence if we become successful technologically. In the case of consuming energy entities such as utilities, there's a conflict of interest. Private utility companies, which by the way mainly exist in the United States, are going to be very hesitant about adopting a technology that's going to wipe out what they call their sunk costs. So they have enormous investments in fossil fuel generators that will become obsolete.
Right.
Now, obviously, you have public producers of energy, which are, tend to be the dominant producers of electricity around the world. And even in the United States, we have TVA, we have Georgia cooperatives, we have cooperatives. These will be a huge market. And we have asked some of them to fund our work so far without success. I think they're waiting for more proof. But we think that, you know, we're not only looking, hoping to be funded as we are now by private investment and private donations, and people have donated to our effort. We hope to be funded not only at the federal government. We've talked to the state of New Jersey, talked to some foreign governments. The amount of money involved, which is, as they say, a total of $100 million, is so insignificant that almost any government could fund us. We could be funded by the city of New York. So we think that maybe once we get through the scientific phase and demonstrate this in the laboratory, that we can produce net energy, then it'll become much easier, we hope. But what we say is what's necessary right now is a crash program to fund fusion. We're not the only non-tokamak method to get to fusion. There are other private companies, and all of them are cheaper routes than tokamak. Obviously, we think our route is the best, but the best way to fund this is a crash program that says, if you have a possible route, we'll give you as much funds as you want. And for, you know, a tenth of 1% of the trillions that have just been thrown down the drain bailing out the banks, the federal government could fund such a crash program. So we think that there should be part of the demands of a mass movement for a way out of this crisis should be the demand for a crash program for fusion energy.
I have a question going back a little bit to the, you mentioned that hydrogen and boron are important for the process, right, of fusion?
Right.
So how is boron obtained, and is there any, I'm just curious about that, and if just potentially, you know, in, externalities, I guess, or you know, right. Outside folks, yeah.
Well, boron is a very common element, and at the moment, because it's common and cheap, it's just mined out of the ground. But boron is so abundant that we calculated that if there was an entire shift to fusion energy and fossil fuels were completely replaced, world boron production would only have to increase 10% to cover all fusion demand. And as I say, boron is pretty widely available. But if any country, you know, that didn't have boron reserves wanted to produce boron, they could just go to the seashore and get it out of sea salt, because boron is a major constituent of sea salt. So you could actually purify it from salt water, from seawater. And routinely, boron has to be removed from seawater because, although boron is necessary to life, seawater has too much boron for plants to absorb. So if you want to desalinate seawater and use it for irrigation, you have to take the boron out of it. So this boron is a natural source. There's no way of monopolizing the sources of boron even if you wanted to try, because you can get it out of seawater. So that's one of the economic consequences of going to fusion. The other is that if you use our fusion method, the devices themselves will be very small. They'll be producing 5 megawatts of power. That's enough for a small community of several thousand homes. So you have decentralized power in which communities and neighborhoods would have their own sources of energy, which is really great for stability. You don't have the possibility of widespread blackouts. And you could have factories manufacturing these devices spread all over the world, basically the same way that you have cars manufactured all over the world. There wouldn't be the possibility for monopolizing the process at any point.
Well, first thing I would say that, you know, is the people have to understand that, like, all our electricity generation right now is based on spinning a magnet, and the spinning of a magnet is from developing steam, and the steam is all from that. That's where you burn the fossil fuels or nuclear power and like that. The only ones that don't require that are things like wind, or hydroelectric, right? And as I understand it from looking at your video, the electricity here has nothing to do with spinning a magnet from steam generation, but is coming out of the plasmoid itself that's generated at that thing that you're trying to make into dense plasma, and that produces an ion beam. And that ion beam, if you had the coils around it, you're thinking that that would be the electricity
that's
producer.
Right. In other words, people have been using beams of ions in accelerators for decades, since the 1930s. And naturally, they want these accelerators to be as efficient as possible. So they've developed techniques to recapture the energy that they put into the beam so they could use it again for the next beam. This is by a process of electromagnetic induction, in which a pulse of electricity can induce, through its magnetic fields, a pulse of electricity in an adjoining conductor. So you have the pulse of electricity, any moving charge is electricity, moving through the plasma, and you induce a current in a circuit, in wires, in essence. And that pulse of electricity can then be captured in capacitors. So that's a well-known process. The technology has been developed at 80% efficiency, and we're going to use that technology to capture the energy without the spinning magnets, without the very expensive equipment that's needed in today's electricity generation. The other part of about one-third of the energy will come off as a burst of X-rays, and we're going to capture that through another well-known technology, which is the photoelectric effect. So we feel that we can get energy conversion, which is, again, far cheaper than the energy conversion that's used in nearly all of today's electricity generation.
In some ways, Eric, it's the you had said in the last episode about how Marx had made this quote of, like, if you want to understand feudalism, understand what was the energy, water mill.
The quote was something to the effect: given a water mill, you get a feudal lord. Given a steam mill, you get a capitalist.
Right, and that here you're saying if you get dense plasma focus, you could have socialism. And I do believe that this technology seems to me like such a threat to the way money runs through our system and the way capital works and capitalism works, that it's very difficult for me to see them allowing this technology to develop prior to a revolution almost. And I don't wonder how you have thoughts about that. Like, it's almost a chicken or egg question. You're kind of implying that the energy source would develop and that might lead to a new kind of society. To me, it sounds like we'd have to have the new kind of society to actually be able to pursue this kind of technology in the way you're talking about. I'm just wondering if you have thoughts about that.
Well, first of all, we have a video which might be coming out, simultaneously with this video. My colleague Ivy wants to comment on that.
He has a hammer.
Because Ivy is producing this video,
yeah,
full steam ahead, and we're going to be talking about the relationship between the present socioeconomic crisis and fusion energy. And obviously, the way we can approach a chicken and egg problem is to say it's a dialectical problem. It's a process. Obviously, if you look back into how the present society emerged, the process of industrialization, which was the process of shifting from wood-based to fossil fuel-based energy, was simultaneous with the process of moving from the social systems that were based on forced labor, serfdom and slavery, to a capitalism based on free labor. I mean, this wasn't one thing and then another. It was both things interacting. Obviously, industrialization in England was well underway by the beginning of the 19th century. But if you look at when it really took off and when standards of living started to rise and life expectancy started to rise in England, it was only after 1865 when the Civil War ended slavery in the United States and led to a tremendous expansion in both industrialization in the agricultural sector as the West was opened up. And in Europe, in England, this was simultaneous with an enormous rise in standard of living. So this was a back and forth process. That's what has to happen today. Obviously, under present society, we're using capitalist techniques, capitalist financing, which is the only financing we can get right now, to do the experimental work to prove fusion is possible. We think we can move forward to fully implement fusion, to make it the fundamental power source. I think is going to be only possible in the course of sweeping away the present financial structure. I mean, people have asked us, you know, a favorite question people have for me at, you know, when I go to parties, when parties were still possible, was, gee, if what you're saying is right, why haven't the oil and gas companies bumped you off? Pleasant thing to get what you're drinking in your hand. Well, the answer is that obviously they don't consider us a threat. They talk to their experts and they say, oh, fusion is 50 years away. Well, let's think about the next quarter. So, but over the long term, sure, the powers that be are the oil and gas companies and their allies in the banking system and in the capitalist system as a whole. But just as in the 19th and early 20th century, the powers that be were swept away, those powers that be, the powers that be today can become the powers that were. We think that it's essential that the idea of the necessity of fusion energy that idea has to become a commonplace within the mass movements that are demanding social change. So people understand that the change in society and the change in the supply of energy have to happen simultaneously. It is a change that has to happen more or less at once. Nobody can predict how far technology will develop before social change limits it, and how far social change develops before technology limits it. But certainly you can say, what you can say definitely is that the establishment of fusion energy will preclude the continuation of the financial system as it is now. The financial system as it is now, fossil fuels have a unique position, that fossil fuel, high-priced fossil fuels are what you might call the black bloodstream of the capitalist system right now. And this has been true historically since the 1970s, when the so-called oil crisis boosted oil prices by a factor of 4 and then 8. So you can't obviously get to everybody having fusion and have the banking system and the financial system the way it is. Sometime before that point, something has to change. And, similarly, you can't get to a society in which everyone has a decent life, everyone in the world has a decent life, and still rely on fossil fuels. Because to give everyone in the world a decent life, we need a minimum of about 3 times, triple the energy now used. And supplying that with fossil fuels will poison all of us. CO2 aside, just the level of particulate pollution would be impossible. And economically, it would clearly be impossible. There would be no way that with high-priced fossil fuels, you can give everybody a decent standard of life. So you definitely cannot get social change to go to a completely new society without fusion energy. You can't get fusion energy to go to completely replace fossil fuels without a profound social change. And, it's not just that Ivy and I can disagree on the sequence. No one can know what that sequence is going to be. But it has to happen in some way over a historical epoch simultaneously for us to get where we're going.
I have a question for you, Eric. You have been a socialist activist for decades, and a member of the Jobs and Equal Rights for All campaign and the International Luxembourgist Network. Can you tell us about your work there, or your membership, your activism?
Very brief summary. My activism started in the 1960s when I was in college. I participated in the civil rights movement and went to the Selma March. I was at Columbia University. I graduated from Columbia in 1968, so I was an active participant in the student strike. I was involved in various socialist movements, but unfortunately, socialist movements in that period did not have sufficient emphasis on the idea of internal democracy. Mm-hmm. And that's really a fatal flaw. So, in the decades afterwards, my activism has covered various things. I was active in the union movement. We had for a number of years the National Writers Union, which was a union of freelance writers, and I was president of the New Jersey local. More recently, in the past couple of decades, I've emphasized the need for a movement strongly supporting immigrant rights, and more broadly, for a movement that unifies our various movements into a common movement for a basic set of common demands. And that's what Jobs and Equal Rights Organization has been about, which is basically the idea that what we need as a minimum is equal rights for all. That means everyone who lives here. No deportation, no detentions, no restrictions on the right of movement. Obviously, protections against the police and so on. Equal rights for all, because without equal rights, we can't fight for anything else. Second of all, we need free, quality public services. We need free education. We need free health care. We need free housing. We need free transportation. The United States is wealthy enough to guarantee all of these things to everyone. And obviously, we need free clean energy. We need a crash program for fusion. We need to finance all that by taking back the money that has been taken over decades by the billionaires, by the rich, taxing that money back. Right now, some of that money can be taken back simply by canceling the bailouts. Mm-hmm. But at the state level, we need to tax the wealth of the rich to finance this. We need to totally eliminate the bloated military budget. Implementing such a program will automatically create jobs for all, because it will create tens of millions of new good jobs. And the necessity of this has become extremely clear with the coronavirus. I read just this morning that school systems, in order to implement social distancing, are going to bring kids back for only one third of the year so that class sizes can be reduced from 30 to 10. Well, I suspect a whole lot of learning is going to take place in those few months, because learning can take place when you have 10 kids in a class, and it probably can take place when you have 30 kids in a class, even for the whole year. But instead of a third of the year, we need an expansion of the school system so class sizes can be reduced radically throughout, so everyone can get a quality education, K through 12, and on into the universities at a much larger scale. And that will create jobs for all. And finally, it is clear that at the moment, the financial system is bankrupt. This is the second time in 10 years that the entire capital of the finance system has been replaced with public money, with, as people are fond of saying, taxpayer dollars. As of the present time, and I'm sure it will change by the end of this show, $3 trillion has been pumped into the financial system. We have to reverse that and say the government has bought the financial system, it owns it, and the financial system has to be run democratically. So that's basically the program that we've been advocating. And right now, popular assemblies are being organized all across the country to try and bring together workers from all different industries who are facing the crisis created by, not created so much by the coronavirus, but created by the failure of society to deal with the coronavirus and to prevent a wholly unnecessary pandemic. So that's the direction that the activism has been going in. Now, also, I participate in the International Luxembourgists Network, which is an international network of people who are in general agreement with the ideas of Rosa Luxemburg. And Luxembourg's key emphasis was on the necessity of democratic organization within the socialist movement. And the main role of the network is to periodically, on occasion, bring out the periodical Mass Strike, which talks about the application of these ideas to the present situation. Mm-hmm. I invite people to visit our website, which is luxembourgism.org, and you can download the issues. We're working on a new issue of Mass Strike, and we invite people to contribute to it if they're in agreement.
That's awesome. I know you also sent me something about July 18th, something going on for July 18th, more on the East Coast, right? And I can put a figure up for it. But do you want to say anything about that?
July 18th, we are calling, we are organizing in the New York, New Jersey area, and we are calling for people to organize in their areas actual demonstrations with social distancing and masks to demand these, what we call the workers' way forward. But specifically, on an emergency basis, to demand the continuation of the $600 a week unemployment compensation, which is the only thing that is keeping most people going, and to extend that to everyone, irregardless of immigration status, including the undocumented, because this is the only thing that's keeping people from starving. And unfortunately, it's not keeping everybody. Everybody is seeing the miles-long line that surrounds the food banks. Mm-hmm. So we have people in the United States of America in the same situation as in the Great Depression, where farmers are throwing away food that they cannot sell, and people are going to food banks because they don't have three meals a day. In some cases, they don't have any meals a day. We have to combat this on an immediate basis. The $600 a day has to be extended to everyone who needs it and has to be continued. And we are also saying that we have to fight to answer the cuts that are coming, that have already been made in vital services like education, by saying, no, reverse the bailout, take it back, take these trillions back, and fund education and other vital social services on a much larger scale. This is the only way to tamp down the pandemic and prevent future pandemics. Because guess what? These viruses are not, you know, waiting. These viruses are developing because of the negative impact the society has had on the environment. They're coming at an increasing pace, and the society has to be ready for them, has to be able to prevent virus outbreaks from turning into pandemics. And we have videos by us and by other experts on our site, the Organizing Committee for Popular Assemblies, that people can look at to get details. But we do invite people to look at our July 18th flyers. They're available in both English and Spanish. You can just fill in your location if you can organize this in the next week.
Yeah, well, I can definitely speak to the value of Rosa Luxemburg's writings. I mean, what she wrote on Reform or Revolution, I use as a touchstone. I read the Mass Strike, that is amazing, and some of her other writings about what was going on, the Junius pamphlet. But also, one of the things I talked with Eduardo and Kenny about was us actually doing a reading on this show a reflection on what is economics, because increasingly I'm finding that we're going to need to understand how economics works. And she does a lot of writing about how economics works is actually obfuscated by the capitalists intentionally. And that's something we're going to have to kind of get over and understand their system, but also understand how they throw sand in our eyes to make economics seem much more complicated than it actually is.
Right. Well, we have other comrades who are working with us and maybe might come on to future shows.
All right.
Jay and other people.
Well, this is, I don't have any more questions. I think this has been great. And I really like appreciate this, right. This summary at the end about how it fits into the changes, the relationship between the development of technology and what's going to have to develop in terms of our social movements and the workers' movement.
Let's conclude then. That does it for this week's episode. We spoke with science writer, researcher Eric Lerner, president and chief scientist at LPP Fusion. We will link to your work and your book, The Big Bang Never Happened, Eric. And we expect that we will probably maybe revisit sometime in the future with you.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, well, thanks for having me. And we look forward to working together.
Yeah.
All right. What's Left is a weekly political podcast / channel challenge to the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes where we found this episode, or on our blog at what-s-left.webmail.com. And you can find past episodes to this podcast / channel there and connect with us. I remind folks, if you like anything that you have heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our 6 platforms on iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, YouTube, or Spotify. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts Andy Lipson and Kenny Cepeda. A big thank you again, once again, Eric.
Okay, thanks for having me. Take care.
Take care.
All right, bye-bye.